I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver. This is thecommentary.ca. Dr. Dixon Despommier joins me now. He is the author of a new book, a fascinating one, The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. It's a provocative yet thoughtful book showing us how we could have our own local food source, especially if we live in an urban center. With food in short supply, the same with water and energy, Dr. Despommier thinks we should build up. Now, scientists, architects, and people around the globe are getting hip to the idea that these specially designed buildings can grow not only food, thanks to hydroponics and aeroponics, but they can be sources of employment. And because of their locations, they would also reduce dependence on fossil fuels in terms of getting the food to the people. Dr. Dixon Despommier spent 38 years as a professor of microbiology and public health and environmental health sciences at Columbia University. He has won numerous awards, and he's been featured in countless national and international media outlets, both print and broadcast. It's a Thomas Dunn book, which is an imprint of St. Martin's Press. The website for more is verticalfarm.com. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Dixon Despommier. Good morning, Dr. Despommier.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Now, I'm interested in how you came to this idea. Is this something that you've been thinking about for a long time, say?
It is, actually. The idea actually started in a class that I teach called Medical Ecology in 1999. So it's not a new idea in terms of urban agricultural initiatives that might solve a lot of problems in terms of fossil fuel use and storage and shipping and that sort of thing. Students began as a think piece, just farming on the rooftops of Manhattan as an idea, and it grew from there. Since that wasn't very practical, we decided to move the whole thing indoors and try it out as a hydroponic setting, and the idea grew from that to the present.
Now, we do have rooftop gardens. I'm sure there are some in Manhattan. There's some here in Vancouver. But in terms of why it's not practical, is it just the volume of it?
Well, you guys have a great weather system that we don't have, you know. You've got the Humboldt Current that keeps all that snow and stuff like that up in the Rocky Mountains and off of the coastline. So you can grow stuff mainly all year long, although, granted, the wintertime is a little bit severe in terms of sunlight.
Yeah.
In New York City, we get some fierce winds coming in, and it goes down below zero in most cases, at least sometime during the winter, which would sort of put a damper on the outdoor farming situation on the rooftops.
Now, the other thing that in reading the book, that you get a sense of, and I knew very little about it, even though we're known in this part of the world for it because of, I guess, grow-ops and the sort,
yep.
Is hydroponics.
Indeed.
It's soil-less, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and I guess that's the other impediment to rooftop gardens, is that you'd need a great deal of soil, right?
Well, I think if you were going to farm in the traditional sense of that word, you're absolutely correct on that. But the fact is that hydroponics doesn't require that. It just allows the root systems to hang down into a nutrient film solution, it's called, or nutrient film technology, I guess, is the way it's formally referred to. You simply dissolve the balance of nutrients into water and then expose the root systems to them, and the plants do the rest. So it actually requires far less weight-bearing loads on roofs, and for that reason it's an ideal setting for doing it indoors.
And what is aeroponics?
Aeroponics takes hydroponics to the next level. It actually creates a mist of nutrient-laden water, which you can then surround the root systems with, and if you allow the root systems to exist in an enclosure that you can control in terms of making that mist happen, you can save tremendous amounts of water this way. In fact, hydroponics, compared to outdoor farming, saves 70% of the water that's used outdoors, and aeroponics saves some 70% of the hydroponic water. So
really?
You can see right away that places like the Middle East, this would be a very attractive alternative.
Now, so for people listening, paint a picture of how it looks.
Sure.
Ideally, you'd want these farms to be 30 stories high, right?
Well, you know, that was another a think piece in our course that we ran. Of course, we were trying to feed 50,000 people with an exercise, and they came up with this 30-story building that's a square New York City block in footprint, which would make it the world's largest volumetric building in the world. I think that's a little grandiose, and I think I would scale that down quite a bit And depending on the availability of land and things of this sort, it could be a very transparent building. Of course, I would intend them all to be transparent, but not so tall. I mean, you could have these 5 or 6 stories tall, and using abandoned city properties throughout the world, and I'm sure every mayor of every city knows just where they are, you could very nicely situate some of these lower, more transparent buildings into the cityscape with very nice results, I think.
And they're transparent, they're glass, because you'd need the solar energy, right?
Well, yes, but I wouldn't pick glass because glass is a little heavy, and there are some wonderful new building materials. One of them is called ethylene, tetrafluoroethylene, of all things. The architects refer to it simply as ETFE. And I know all of your listeners will be familiar with it because if you watched the Olympics in Beijing, the swimming venue was actually made out of that material. So it's lightweight, it's transparent, it's very tough, and in fact, the surface quality of this allows it to be self-cleaning. So if you just run a little water over it each time to wash off the surface, these windows made out of ETFE can actually clean the air for you if you'd like.
Yeah. Now, the Apple building in Manhattan, is that the same material?
It's not, but I use it as an example of a transparent building. That's basically why I picked it, because it's an iconic building. People go to it and say, wow, what is that? And, you know, if you could just imagine that maybe 5 stories tall and maybe an eighth of a city block in footprint with layers of crops growing on each of the floors, you get some picture of what a futuristic vertical farm might look like.
So what can be grown? I guess tomatoes, lettuce. Sorry?
I said just name it.
Yeah.
In fact, NASA started supplying us with a crop list that they thought would be appropriate for astronauts to take into outer space and to supply all the basic nutrients that that they would need in order to carry out life in places like the Moon or Mars or even beyond. And that was back in the late 1980s that they had this list already amassed. Today, you can find virtually every commercial crop growing indoors someplace throughout the world.
So we could
that includes tea and coffee and wine grapes and all kinds of other things.
So that would include things that would need soil, say like potatoes or carrots, mushrooms?
Well, you can use something called rock wool, which is not soil. It's a volcanic deposit, and by remanufacturing it into a lightweight, spongy material, you can actually get plants to grow down into it. And, that's what I said when I first heard about that, too. I said, oh, yeah, show me. And, in fact, that was no problem for people to show me. A lot of horticulturists are out there using it right now. In fact, you use it to actually start these plants out when you design nurseries for these greenhouses. They use rock wool in order to germinate the seeds and to get the little seedlings going before they transplant them into the hydroponic setting. So you can grow root vegetables in a pumice-like material. It thinks it's soil, but of course it's not soil, but the water does percolate through it and supply the root systems with all the nutrients that those plants need. So you can raise potatoes and celery and carrots and rutabaga and all kinds of other root vegetables if that's what you want to do.
Now, what do companies like Monsanto and sort of fertilizer companies have to say about vertical farms?
I wish I knew.
No?
You know, they haven't contacted me at all. I don't think they feel threatened by this whatsoever. And in fact, I think that they should think this is a good idea, because this is a good way for them to have to stop subsidizing lots of farms that have actually failed and to create an industrial complex for themselves where they could raise virtually anything they wanted right next door to where the manufacturing takes place. So I think that you might see this actually happening.
And indoors, see, I know nothing about the things that I eat. Indoors, if you've got if you're growing vegetables, say in a vertical farm, does the growth time does that decrease?
Yes, in fact, I mean, just imagine what it would be like to raise anything under ideal conditions. And basically, what you create indoors is the ideal condition under which a given crop plant grows, and so you can match exactly the requirements for, let's say, a common crop that everybody's familiar with, corn, which I wouldn't pick as my first crop indoors, but you can do them. I'll give you an example there. When you plant corn outdoors in most places, you get one crop for the whole year because, of course, you have the seasons to come into play here. When you plant these things indoors under hydroponic conditions, you can have as many as 8 different crops a year of that same corn plant.
Yeah.
So it's quite remarkable.
Yeah. Now, you also mentioned coffee, tea.
Yes.
Agriculture, livestock, that can also be grown?
Well, I would stop just short of livestock. I think livestock is going to be a problem here. You'll pardon the outdoor noises, but my office is right above an emergency room.
Right. Yeah. Aquaculture?
Yeah, absolutely, aquaculture. And I know that people in your neck of the woods are quite familiar with raising salmon and other saltwater fish. You could get that to work indoors as well. And, in fact, lots of indoor aquacultural settings are already in existence.
Now, you mentioned that we're familiar with it. We are, in terms of farmed salmon.
Yeah.
There's a great deal of, in terms of the consumer, is quite vocal here in this part of the woods, about the quality of farmed salmon.
Yep.
People prefer the wild to the farm.
Sure.
In terms of what's grown in the vertical farm, the quality, not just of aquaculture that could be grown there, but fruits and vegetables?
You know, it's the history of this technology, the hydroponic and aeroponic technologies, in the very beginning of the industry, which was about, let's say, started around 20 years ago, the growers thought the public wanted perfect-looking produce. So they produced perfect-looking produce, which didn't taste so good. It was kind of mushy, in fact. Waterlogged tomatoes, for instance, mm-hmm. were not comparable at all to the outdoor-grown tomatoes of the local regions where these greenhouses were located. But as consumer pressure was placed on those growers to produce fruit and vegetables that not only looked good but also tasted good, they began to realize that they better go back and re-examine how they produce them. And, in fact, many of the growers, not all of them, have realized that if you take the water away from plants that you're about to harvest, maybe 2 or 3 days before harvest, and stress them a little bit to allow them to produce their flavor molecules in abundance, you not only concentrate the sugars inside of a plant, but you also concentrate their taste molecules, which are called flavonoids. And there's a grower out in the middle of the Arizona desert called Eurofresh Farms, which actually does this quite well. And they win blind tasting contests for their tomatoes throughout the entire country in the United States as a result of their knowledge of how to make hydroponic produce taste good.
Now, George Monbiot has written about you and this concept, and he's called it towering lunacy. He says that these models aren't cost-effective, that they don't control disease, and that you still need to use fossil fuels.
Yeah, that's what he says. And I'm not about to get into an argument with him. I think everybody's entitled to their own opinions, but I think it's very difficult to criticize an idea that hasn't actually happened yet. So that's like criticizing the first airplane because, you know, we didn't know how to make them fly. And basically we're at that stage where we're suggesting that we grow food in tall buildings, but we actually don't know how to do that yet. We know how to grow them in a single-layered greenhouse, but to stack them on top of each other and to integrate the systems is a difficult engineering feat. And for that reason, and for other reasons too, but mainly for those reasons, they haven't appeared on the scene yet. They're about to appear. The engineers and agronomists and microbiologists are about to get a hold of this system, and as a result, they will work out the details of all the issues surrounded with economics, energy utilization, crop selection, yields, water reuse, keeping out plant diseases and those sorts of things. And so I think anybody who starts criticizing this idea at a technical level doesn't actually have faith in the technology sector that this world of ours presents to us. I mean, you know, come on, in a very short period of time, we went from a one-stage rocket to a three-stage rocket and got people to the moon and back, I should say, many times over, in fact, and we've even captured the dust from the tail of a comet and brought it back to Earth for analysis. And I think if we can do those things, we can certainly do this without technical impediments. I don't think any of the technologies are lacking in order to go forward with this. So anytime I hear criticism at that level, I always think of what they would have said if they had lived in a different time and encountered similar inventions back at the 18th century or 19th century. I think they would have still been the naysayers, and I think naysayers force the people with the visions to go forward and prove them wrong, and that's what we're about to do.
So what is the impediment then to seeing a prototype? Is it building codes? Is it just finding the right land?
No, I don't think there are any impediments. I think I think capital is one of those investment areas that you would have to convince either angel investors, which are people with lots of money and the best interests of the earth at heart, to invest in this to begin with. The mayor of Surrey, of British Columbia, by the way, just across the river from you guys,
yeah,
is extremely interested in this idea. And I know that there, you've got a guy working for you now who I deeply respect. His name is Sadu Johnston.
Mm-hmm.
He's a big advocate of this, and I think that your area of the world will see this happen sooner than later. And not because you have to, but rather because you want to. Areas of the world that have to and will see this happen soon are places in the Middle East. One of those places is Qatar, and they are deeply interested in securing a food supply that they themselves control. Right now, they import over 90% of their food. They think this approach is a wonderful idea, and to them, the money is not the problem. It's having their own food supply that they can trust is the problem, and they're going to solve it this way, by the way. So I think very soon you'll see real progress in terms of vertical farming.
Now, doesn't this mean the end of rural life in America and in Canada?
Gee, I hope not.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to see that happen at all. I think rural life, what if you were a farmer that had 3 years in a row of failed farming, and you're throwing up your hands and not knowing what to do, and someone came along and told you, well, from now on, I don't want you to farm. What I want you to do is watch that hardwood forest grow back, and I'm going to pay you for the carbon credits that the trees sequester in terms of CO2. This is the real promise of this, is that if you don't have to farm outdoors much anymore, you can actually return the land to what it used to be before we farmed, and you can restore ecosystem functions and services. And I know that particularly in the Pacific Northwest, both in the United States and in Canada as well, that there's a huge conflict between wild salmon farming and wild salmon runs,
mm-hmm,
and logging. The indiscriminate taking away of an entire watershed for the sake of producing lumber trashes that river system, and it really spoils another industry. And in this way, you could actually get both of those to come back.
Now, you said that we'll see this soon. Where should we look, and how long do you think?
You're asking me to predict the future. It's hard enough to predict the past, but I'll give you my best guess anyway. Based on all of the feedback that I've been getting over the last 2 or 3 years, I am confident that the Middle East will have examples of vertical farms within the next year. There are places throughout the United States that are busy scurrying about, not just finding financial support for it, but also consumer buy-in. And Whole Foods is one of those companies that has a vision that right now they want to convert their entire rooftop system, wherever they have stores, to greenhouses that are enclosed. I think that's a first step. I think the next thing you want is a 2 or 3-story greenhouse, and by that definition, those would be vertical farms. So I think you're going to see a lot of first steps and then second steps, just like we did for any other major technological program that we invent, cancer research, space travel, nanotechnology, vertical farming. I would throw that into the mix just like I would for those other things. And it's a growth industry that starts small and builds up momentum, and people see what it's all about, and the next thing you know, everybody wants it.
Now, do you think in the long run, say a vertical farm is erected soon, that this will change our consumption habits? Because, I mean, that's as much a problem as anything else, right?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, if you think of the places that desperately need these, let's take a global view first, and then I can bring it back to the Western world. If you go to sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, or if you go to China or India, where farming is a major problem, and in many cases it's impossible because of a huge drought that blew all the wind blew all the soil away, or a huge flood that followed that drought that also washed all the soil away. The options are zero for farming afterwards. They're in desperate need for some other alternative for agriculture. So I think these offer them those possibilities, and I think they're adopting them, in fact, and including them into plans for the near future. If you take any inner city population in the United States where poverty exists, of course, and where food deserts, as they're called, exist, the insinuation of a vertical farm complex that produces fresh produce could easily address some of those major issues and reverse those situations and address issues like teenage obesity and type 2 diabetes, etc.
Dr. Despommier, this is just a fascinating book. I've enjoyed the conversation today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
The book is called The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. It's a Thomas Dunn book, which is an imprint of St. Martin's Press. The book, the website is verticalfarm.com. Dr. Dixon Despommier on the line from New York City. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.